Tonight is the 10th of May, the year 2000. We are going to, first of all, fill in the remainder of the first parak of Rosh Hashanah. We're on Chof Beis of an Aleph, B22A, and then we, Yot HaShem, start also the second parak tonight. Okay. The previous tape left off in the middle of a discussion about whether, when it comes to Eidos HaChodesh, in other words, giving testimony before the Beis Din that they have seen the new moon, whether the testimony of the father and the son can be valid. The reason why the question is raised is, of course, the fact that not everybody is qualified to serve as a witness, and one of the big disqualifications as a witness is what we call probing. In other words, if you are related by blood, you know, to somebody else, or maybe even through marriage to somebody else, and in that particular case, the two of you cannot serve as witnesses. One can be a witness, but the other one cannot be a witness together with you. And, of course, we require what? We require two witnesses, because, as the Torah says, Afishnayim Edim, Afishnayim Yukum Dover, right? Anything that has to do requires at least two or three witnesses. So, that being the case, the question is whether they relax the rule as far as the giving testimony for having seen the new moon, because it was so vitally important, you know, for the Beis Din to know so that they could officially declare that it was the new month, or whether the rules still apply. So as we heard at the conclusion of the previous one, so originally the thought was that Rabbi Shimon had said that it is permissible, and they brought a case about the Tuvia HaRofe, Tuvia the doctor, and his son, and who also came together with her Evid, with the slave. And we saw over there that at first the reading is that the father and the son would be accepted. Then they rejected that and they said no, it's the father and the slave who were to be accepted. And of course, I don't have to tell you, a slave too, frankly, is among those who are considered disqualified in order to serve as a witness. So it's very puzzling. So the last sentence that we had on the previous tape, so it was, yes. So Rav Huna said to Rav Chanan bar Rava, it says that the Rabbi Yossi and the Maisa, and you say, you know, that that Halacha follows Rabbi Shimon. So he said to him, Omar Lo, he says, well, Zin and Sagin, many times Amit Kamei the Rav, many times I've said that the present of Rav, that Hilchos HaKa Rabbi Shimon, that whenever Rabbi Shimon has a machlokes with somebody else, the Halacha follows Rabbi Shimon. The Lo Amar Li V'lo Midi, and he didn't say anything to protest what I said to him. That is, Rav did not protest when I made the statement to him. So, Omalei, so he said unto him, Hechiton Nisa, he says, how did you learn? In other words, what report did you have concerning, according, you know, what the halacha follows in this particular case? So he says, Omalei, Ipko, he says, I heard just the opposite. In other words, not a father and a son, but you have to have independent witnesses. So he says, that's the part of the reason why Rav didn't say anything to you, because he knew that the halacha should be just the opposite of what you report. So Omar Tavi Berei the Mori Tavi. So Tavi, the son of Mori Tavi, said, Omar Marukba in the name of Marukba, Omar Shmuel in the name of Shmuel, and Halacha Hilchasol to Rabbi Shimon. Halacha does follow Rabbi Shimon. All right, so the question is again, and therefore then what? So Omalei, he says, Mishimon, right. So he says, because he was the voter, you know, you reported that Rabbi Shimon said actually the opposite, so therefore this is why we can say that the Halacha follows Rabbi Shimon, and that a father and a son should not be acceptable for Eidos HaChodesh. And since they already have mentioned people who are disqualified from serving as witnesses, not just Krogan, as we've said, in other words, people related to each other, and I mentioned the word Evan, so here we have another listing, which is similar to a listing that we find in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Elohim Apsulim, these are the following people who would be invalid to serve as witnesses. One of them is Hamsachi Bekuvya. This is a person who is a gambler. Literally, he plays dice all the time. Now, it doesn't mean, actually, that he only gets into a game occasionally. That's what the Gemara in Sanhedrin says. What it means is that someone who spends all his time doing this, and I'll explain in a second why they say that. And then another one is the Malvei Berevis. These are people who lend money on interest, but of course we know that
you're not allowed to lend money on interest.
It's a mitzvah, right, to lend without taking any interest. Mafricha Yonim are those who like to have pigeon racing, okay? As the Gemara says in Sanhedrin over there, you know, you bet my dove will get to the dovecot faster than your dovecot will. They bet upon it, okay? So, look, Mafricha Yonim could also be, you know, people who go and then bet on the horses too. My horse will come in before your horse. Okay. The Sochare Shviyas, and these are people who do business with the produce of Shviyas, Va'avodim, and slaves. Okay, let me now explain some of these that are not so obvious. First of all, Tzachi Bekuvya, and also Mafricha Yonim. These, as we indicate, are people who indulge in gambling. But does it mean the occasional gambler? The Gemara in Sanhedrin says no. What it means is that these are people who gamble all the time. They have no other source of income, no other panos. All they do is to spend all their time in gambling. So the question in the Gemara over there is, I mean, why are these disqualified as witnesses? And the answer is because Shenom Atzokim be Yeshuva Shalema. The answer is because they are not engaged in anything in a gainful occupation. They don't have anything to do other than this one interest of gambling, and therefore, how could they come and serve as witnesses in the court when they've had no experience with life outside of gambling? So that's the reason why. Now, some of the others are obviously, they have violated laws of the Torah, and therefore, on that basis, they are prohibited. Namely, the person who lends money on interest, where we know that it's a mitzvah to lend money without taking any interest.
Well, spend money to a non-Jew.
To a non-Jew, it's permissible.
The
Torah says so specifically.
Specifically says that one who lends interest.
On interest, right.
Yeah, but it doesn't say only to a Jew.
Well, the Torah specifies only to a Jew, right. That they're not allowed to take interest from a Jew. That's why we have Gibilis Chesed, you see. Okay, yeah. But the Torah does say, La'nochri sashik, which means you are permitted, however, to take interest from a non-Jew. That you can do. You're not bound by the same one.
And then
because there you're engaged only in a commercial transaction. Right, it's a business in that particular case.
You're taking interest from you.
No, Mela. Okay. I'm talking from the point of view of what the Torah itself says. Okay?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Of course, I'm not going into the story right now. If that's the case, how come that we deal with banks, we take out mortgages, and we pay, and believe me, in Eretz Yisrael, the interest that they have to pay over there is far, far greater than anything that we have anything in this country. The banks make a tremendous amount of business, not just on the mortgages,
so how do they do that?
But also upon what is called overdraft. If you live in Israel, Leolenu, where the salaries are not so good, the bank is willing to extend credit to you, but then comes the day when they say, we can no longer extend more credit to you. And, you know, in the meantime, you are paying interest, even if you haven't paid the loan. You understand? So the day of reckoning does come, but in the meantime, the banks are cleaning up over there.
What happens? They go bankrupt then? They go into bankruptcy?
They try to pay back. Somehow or other you will look. The average Jew does not want to go bankrupt. Yeah, business will go bankrupt. Why? Because it's considered a harp and a shanda. Right. You should learn to live within your means, there's no question. I mean, take a look, with Pirkei Avos, right?
Yeah.
Beginning of the fourth parak over there,
We have the famous statement which says, you know, who is wise, who is a hero, and so, and then, okay, Ezehu Asher, who is a rich person? The answer is Hasameach Bechelko, which means that if you're happy with your lot in life, you understand, you learn how to live within your means and not to overspend and so on, and be satisfied. You don't have to have the fanciest car, you don't have to have the fanciest home. You do what you know is within your means in order to be able to do, so that you don't have to go into debt as a result of it. But Israel, unfortunately, has learned from America how to want things. You know, people want television with cable, and I'll tell you, also they spend tremendous amount of money. If you want to live in Yerushalayim or in Tel Aviv, the cost of apartments is extremely expensive. They don't have rentals. You know, there are some rentals, but by and large, people actually have to pay. They have to buy their own apartment over there. Okay, this is the normal practice that you have. You buy your apartment, and to try to buy an apartment in Yerushalayim is extremely expensive. The same is true of Tel Aviv and some of the other big cities as well.
How do the banks get around it?
Okay, so now you ask the vital question, how do they do it? The answer is that, you know, they have this fiction, just as, for example, for Pesach, you sell to a goy.
The
bank also, they have a business whereby you become a partner with the bank in the business. It's what is called a shtar heter iska, okay? Heter iska means that you're permitted to do business if you enter into a partnership agreement. So you as a depositor, you understand, or as a borrower, are actually entering into a business with the bank whereby the two of you are engaged in a joint enterprise, okay? It's on that basis.
How can they justify, that doesn't answer the question, how do they justify charging interest?
The answer is very simple. The bank is out for business. The average person needs the money from the bank. Okay? How many free loan societies do you think that there are? There are some, but not enough to cover the entire population of Israel, obviously. So you have to do it. So therefore, they have to resort to something legal in order to be able to justify it. Okay? I mean, it's on the same basis. All right. Yeah. I mean, when we go in, let's say, to a bank in this country, and naturally we want to see interest on our bank accounts, on our CDs and things like that. But the principle, theoretically, would be about the same. Namely, that you're actually engaged in the business together with them. If the bank makes money, then you'll make a little money, too, in the form of the interest that you get. You understand? So that you're sort of partners with them in the common enterprise. I'm not saying, you know, that...
it sounds a little bit much to pay up.
Okay. You can find fault with everything. But the point is, people still have to live and they have to learn how to do that, you know, how to get along with the means of being able to obtain the credit that they need, that's all. Okay. So that's the business about the person, you know, who lends money on interest. And how about Socheri Shviz? We know that the produce that grows in the seventh year is meant to be eaten by everybody, so that you're not allowed to do business with it. Therefore, if you do business with the fruits and you know, the vegetables that grow in Shviyas, therefore you are violating the law of the Torah, which says that it's to be free for everyone. And therefore, on that basis, because you are violating the Torah, that's the reason why. As far as avodim are concerned, as far as slaves are concerned, the answer is, of course, that to serve as a witness, you have to be considered a full-fledged Israelite. The Eved is an Israelite in many respects, and yet he still has a certain class stigma or social stigma or something like that. It's not accepted. I don't know if you remember when we learned Kedushin, for example.
Remember
when we learned Kedushin, I mean, who can contract marriages? The answer is a Kohen, a Yisrael, a Levi, they can contract marriages, okay. But as far as Avodim, Avodim can only marry maidservants, shrochets. But they cannot marry, for example, a full-fledged Israel woman, unless, you know, he becomes Eved Meshuchar, you know.
How about
becomes
Jewish woman?
Huh? You know, I'm talking.
Okay, so they,
yeah, I'm
so
talking
they,
about
so they, maybe
if they were emancipated,
yeah,
okay,
no
then
longer.
In that case, then they're no longer Avodim. Okay, so in then, then after that, if they want to contract a marriage, they're like anybody else, you understand? But during the time that they're still slaves, then in that particular case, they cannot marry a full-fledged woman, you know. I'll say gate this. This is the law, okay? All right. So, therefore, their testimony, too, is considered, you know, not reliable. Zahak Lal.
What happened to the dove races?
What happened to what?
The pigeon races.
Oh, the pigeon races. Well, they're gamblers, as I said.
There's gamblers, like...
Gamblers, like the dice players.
So,
right.
Not to be
trusted. Yeah, right, right.
Not to be,
yeah, and the Gemara and Sanhedrin, the two of them are paired together. Right, yeah.
Shreya's merchants?
Well, Shreya's merchants, as I said, I mean, you are violating the Torah by doing business with fruits or vegetables that grow in the seventh year. Okay, right. Okay. And slaves. Zach Lol, this is the general rule, says the Mishnah, call Eidush, Eidush, or Kishera law, any kind of testimony in which we cannot accept the testimony of a woman, Ath Hainin and Kishera law, then they too, we cannot accept the testimony of these people who are mentioned. So, naturally, that brings the next question. When can we accept it?
When can we accept what?
The testimony of a woman. Okay? So, of course, the answer is there are certain cases in which we can accept the testimony. One of the outstanding, actually, I would say there are two outstanding categories, okay? One of them is to testify about the death of a person. We want to make sure that women are not going to be agunas, right? We want to make sure that they'll be able to remarry after the death of a husband. So in that case, it's very important to be able to know when the person has died, to be able to identify a person who has died, and therefore, even if one person only saw it happen, and even if that one person were only a woman, then in that case, we accept the testimony of that particular person. And therefore, any one of these different characters over here, who we say normally we would not accept the testimony, but if they testified that they saw, you know, a person who died, then in that particular case, their testimony is acceptable. Okay. The other category is what we say, Eid Echad Demon Biyasurin, which means that, for example, something milchuk falls into fleshuk, or vice versa. Okay? Testimony of one person is enough to say that they saw it happen, what, you know, under what circumstances. You don't have to have two witnesses in order to testify that, for example, let's say a drop of milk fell into a fleshuk temple or something like that. You understand? So, therefore, the testimony of a single person is automatically accepted. And that can be applied also to some other categories as well, okay? So, for these, definitely a woman's testimony is acceptable. And if a woman's testimony is acceptable, then so it would be for any of the other people who are mentioned over here in this last Mishnah, the first parak. Okay. The Gemara continues. Yeah, and it says, right, woman is just as a woman is kosher to be accepted as a witness in these cases, so in that case they too, in other words, wherever the woman will be acceptable, then in that particular case, then it would also be acceptable for any of these people to testify. Okay. Omer Rav Ashi, so Rav Ashi says, Zosameris, in that case, he says, Gaslan Divrehen Kishen Ladis Isha. If that's the case, he says, that someone who is considered a Gaslan, according to the laws of the rabbi, they should also be permitted. In other words, what is he referring to? He's referring to the fact that, for example, as Rashi says over here, he says the Eidus Isha, he says La Tiro Lihinose. When we want to permit a woman to get married, in other words, she's been, let's say she lost her husband, and we want to enable her to remarry, right? So it's the Dafka Gazan Nivrei. What kind of a Gazan are we talking? We're talking about someone who violated a law that the rabbi set up. Avol Gazan Nivrei. But if a person is a Gazan, according to the laws of the Torah, the Chotzit La'avobathai Hesya, who had the chutzpah, says Rashi, to transgress openly in the presence of other people, lo hichira chashkomim le'idus isha. And the rabbis did not say that he is valid to give testimony for a woman. The yafal pishach shira is a eved, is a isha, the psuli raisa. And this is in spite of the fact that they say that a slave or a woman who are, according to the law of the Torah, not valid for testimony, but the sages accepted, but not that of somebody who's a gazlan, the oraisa. Another question is, what is a gazlan or oraisa? In other words, a gazlan according to the law of the Torah. The answer is, okay, he stole from somebody, right? But the case, for example, of, let's say, the gamblers. Okay, when you gamble, there is a certain amount of ganeva which is involved in it. Let me explain. This is a very complicated law that we find mentioned several places in the Talmud. This is only one category of it, okay? This is what we say, yesh breira. Of course, now yesh breira means that you have an opportunity to, you have a choice, right? But when the Gemara is using the expression yesh breira or ein breira, they're really referring to something which is very technical, okay? What is breira? Breira means that you
have choice.
Are,
choice.
Not exactly. I have to explain. Okay. In the case of a gambler, all right, let's take it. Okay. You're sitting down and you are saying, okay, I'm going to sit down with my friends and I'm going to play poker, okay? If I win, that's my luck. If I lose, it's my hard luck, right? But in the final analysis, if I win, I'm taking money that the other person may not, in his mind, have decided that he wants to give to me. In other words, he may have great charata in paying up. You understand what I'm saying? So that, therefore, we are really taking money which sort of stayed in that other person's pocket, because who told him to be a gambler or to get engaged in a poker game before the stake? But we are betting on the result that if I'm lucky, I'll be able, then the money will be mine. Okay. So therefore, there is a certain amount of ganevish shtick, let's say, okay? Ganevish shtick is involved in it. So he would be then a gazlan to divreha. In other words, the sages said that, because obviously there's no law in the Torah that says
you can't
gamble and you can't accept the winnings of a gamble, right? That's why, of course, everybody buys lottery tickets, because when you buy a lottery ticket, you're also gambling on the fact that maybe you'll be the lucky one to get the right sequence of numbers and so on. So this is just one example of it. There are many more things that I can't begin to go into the whole business of yesh breira and ein breira. But this is what we mean by gazlan divreihem, that actually they're not really violating the law of the Torah, but still the rabbis themselves look down upon this whole idea of gambling as a source of making money. Okay? So, as the Gemara then says over here, then the Samaritan, that's the case, says gazlan divreihem when it comes, to a violation of the laws that the sages gave, and you're stealing, as the example I gave you, then sharing later session, then they are permitted, they are valid as witnesses in order to enable a woman to remarry. The last Mishnah of the chapter says, Mi Shiroas HaChodesh, V'yenu Yochel HaHalech, if a person saw the new moon and he cannot walk to the you know, to go to Yerushalayim in order to give his testimony, then molichin oso al hachamor, then they're permitted to lead him on a donkey. He's permitted to ride on the donkey in order to get there. Afilu b'mita, even it says like on a stretcher, so to speak. Okay. Vim sodalehem, and if on the road to Yerushalayim they're aware that there are highwaymen who are out, you know, to ambush them, to steal from them, then lokhim biyodem maklos, then the people who are going to Yerushalayim, accompanying the witness, they're permitted to take in their hands sticks. In other words, they're permitted, you know, to have weapons. V'yimhoi soder chachoyka, and if the way was very far from Yerushalayim, in other words, it would require, you know, for example, like staying overnight or something like that, then in that particular case, lokhim biyodem mezoinos, they're permitted to carry food with them. Now, of course, what are we talking about? We're talking about even on Shabbos. This is the whole idea. I mean, you know, if it's a weekday, so it's garnished. They can ride, they can walk, they can do whatever they want. They can buy food on the way, and so on. And that's not the problem. The problem is that we said that the witnesses who have seen the new moon, they're permitted to violate Shabbos in that, you know, that they have to travel in order to get to the Beis Din, so that could give their testimony. So in this case, we are pointing out that there are certain exceptions that are made in reference to the strict observance of Shabbos in order to enable them to carry out their mission. Sha'al mehalech laila v'yom, because if it is a journey which requires a night and a day, then mechalal nisah Shabbos, then these witnesses are permitted to violate Shabbos, the yotzim neidisah chodesh, and they go in order to give the testimony that they have seen the new month. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Eilim u'adei Hashem, these are the festivals of the Lord, what we'll be reading this Shabbos, and yotzah Hashem, Asher tikru osam b'ma'adon, which you have to proclaim in their proper season. Now, who has the authority then to proclaim the festivals of the Lord in the proper season? The answer is, it's the Beis Din Yerushalayim. So in order to be able to establish the dates for it, then in that particular case, they relaxed these restrictions, you know, on people who have to go in order to give the testimony, so that the Beis Din can carry out its function of proclaiming when it's Rosh Chodesh and setting thereby when the festivals of God are to occur. I just want to point out that in another Gemara, where you have, for example, in the Gemara of Beitza and so on, where they also refer to this, there's a play of words. Take a look how the word osam is written. Here it's spelled with a vav, right? But in the Torah, the vav is missing. So that therefore, how would you read the word?
Same
way. No, yeah, I mean, of course, we know that it should be read as osam. But if you only see aleph, tav, mem, more likely you're going to read it as what? Atem. In other words, tikru atem. You, Beis Din, you have the authority, you have the power to proclaim this, and therefore you have the power also to enact those rules which will enable the proper proclamation of the new month and the festivals. So this is how they interpret. Okay.
It seems so wrong, even if it's in here.
Yeah.
Because you're doing the wrong thing,
yeah.
The right thing.
You're right. I mean, as a normal rule, you're 100% then, you're 100% right. What do we call it? We call it mitzvah haboah ba'avera. Right? You're performing a mitzvah as a result of a transgression. And we say normally that mitzvah bo ba'avera is lashmo mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah. You should not violate, you know, just in order that you shouldn't violate the law of the Torah in order to be able to say that you can carry out a mitzvah.
Especially
a
Shabbos.
Yeah. I mean, for example, it's obvious. If a person, for example, steals money and then gives it into the pushka. Sure, giving to the pushka is a mitzvah. But is it right? Of course, it's not right, you see. So that's why we say that normally mitzvah is not a mitzvah. But in this particular case, they were able to relax the rules a little bit, okay? Because the Chachom in the final analysis, I have to explain one other thing. We have certain categories of halachas where the violation is considered shavus. Shavus means literally that just don't do things, okay? Don't do things. This is literally what it means. But in reality, what shavus works out is that we add certain chumras, we add certain stricter observance, right, to what the Torah itself has to say in order to make sure that ultimately there would not be any violation of the Torah itself. Okay? So this is shvus, and this I can give you many examples. Okay? For example, why don't we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah if it's on Shabbos? Yeah, that's what the Gemara says, because you want to make sure that you know how to blow the shofar, so you're going to carry the shofar to shul. Alright. So, should this apply, for example, in a place where you have an Erev? Or if you left the shofar inside the shul itself, you don't have to carry it? Nevertheless, in order to avoid something like that, so we don't blow shofar on Shabbos, okay? In the Beis HaMikdash, they did blow on Shabbos. But of course, in the Beis HaMikdash, the rules of Shavuos, as a normal rule, did not apply, okay? Because the service of the Beis HaMikdash required blowing the shofar. After all, how many days Rosh Hashanah do they observe in the days of the Beis HaMikdash? Normally, only one, okay? So that being the case, it wouldn't be Rosh Hashanah without blowing the shofar. We observe 2 days, so we sort of get around it. I mean, that we can blow on the second day if we don't blow on the first day, if it's Shabbos. Okay, but that's Shavuos. Okay, the same thing refers, for example, you know, not to. Why don't we, you know, take the lulav on the first day, Sukkot, for example, if it's on Shabbos? A similar reason. We don't do it for that reason. Okay, so that's Shavuos. The Torah doesn't say, in other words, you're not allowed to, you know, to shakel a lulav on the first day of Sukkot if it's Shabbos. It doesn't say so. All it says is that you are to take it on the first day, right, and take the four species and so on and so forth. It says you do take it, right? But we observe, you know, the idea of Shavuos. Okay. Now, the same thing is true in the case of these witnesses. Okay? You follow me? There are two violations over there, which I guess we could really boil down to one major violation. And that is the violation of going beyond a Tchum Shabbos. Okay? We know that the Torah says, Al Yetze Yishu Mekom Yom HaShabbos, nobody is to go out from his place on the Shabbos. Of course, at that time they were referring to, don't go out and gather mud, right? But we apply it in general that you don't go out. What do you mean you don't go out? So they explain that Al Yetze means it refers to what they call Hotsa'ah. In other words, taking out something. You're not allowed, you know, to carry something. You understand? That's Hotsa'ah. Okay, this is how we interpret it in the Gemara in Shabbos. Okay? Now, Tchum Shabbos. Does the Torah actually say that on Shabbos we're not allowed to go more than Alpayamama? Understand? Doesn't say that. We learn the idea of Tchum from a different case, where we learn that, for example, the Torah has set aside, this is the end of Sefer Bamidbar, the Torah has set aside cities for the Levium. Okay? And it's written over there that you are to measure the Chusayir Alpayim Ba'amah. Okay? So, from that we learn that what? That the boundaries of a city extend to 2,000 amos beyond. So that, therefore, by applying one thing to the other, you understand? This is how we arrive at the fact that the Tchum Shabbos is Apai Mama beyond the boundaries of the city. Okay. Of course, we're not talking now about, for example, Springfield and Longmeadow or Springfield and Chicopee, where they're all contiguous. You have houses, you know, from one place to another so that you can't really tell where one ends and the other begins, except for the fact that they put up a signpost or something like that. Okay? But in the final analysis, the amount of the tchum is really determined by whom? By the rabbanim, by the sages. They were the ones, you know, who made the comparison, and they decided that this was it. Okay? Now, if it is with Ephraim, therefore they have a certain authority that if a person has to walk beyond the tchum Shabbos in order to go and to give the testimony, you understand? Then in that particular case, they are now giving permission, because in that particular case, it overrides the other ordinance that they made. Okay? And the same thing with, let's say, carrying the person or riding. This is also in the category of shmos. Okay? So that I don't want to demean the importance of shmos, because we all observe it. I mean, Shabbos wouldn't be Shabbos without it, and Yontav wouldn't be Yontav without all these things, and so on. We observe all these things. But the sages do have the authority that sometimes they can sort of suspend one rule that belongs in their particular province in order to carry out something else, which the Torah said that they have the obligation to pronounce. This is Asher Tikru Osom Ma'adam. You have the obligation to go and to proclaim Rosh Chodesh at this particular time. And in order to fulfill this law of the Torah, this is where they can suspend a rule of the Chachamim in order to carry it out. So that this is the answer. Okay? Alright. So with that, we finish the first chapter of Rosh Hashanah, chapter Arba Rosh Hashanah V'Heim, right? And now we're going to begin the second chapter. We are Chaf Beis Omid Aleph at the very bottom, okay? And the Mishnah begins by saying, now remember, the last Mishnahs that we dealt with in the previous chapter dealt with who is valid in order to give testimony before the Beis Din, so that they can proclaim Rosh Chodesh, okay? So the Mishnah says that if they don't know the man, what do you mean they don't know the man? They don't know whether he is an honest person, the one who has come before them in order to testify. Then in that case, the local authorities, the local Beis Din from where this person comes from, would send somebody else with him in order to testify that they know this person.
Terrifying.
And you know, his word can be you know, his word can be accepted that he actually had seen the moon as he claimed. Okay. Okay. Borishana, at first, Hoyim Mekablim Edus HaKodesh Mekol Adam, they would accept testimony concerning the new moon from any person, whatever. Any Jew was permitted, you know, to come, and they would accept it prior, you know, like sort of almost like prima facie, you know, that this person can be trusted, okay, without having to go into too much interrogation as to whether this person was really Ne'aman, whether he was trustworthy or not. But Mishakilkalu Abai Susim, when Abai Susim made things kadya, in other words, they spoiled things, speak about that in a second, is kilu shoyehum kabdim elabin abakirin. So then they made a takana, in other words, they made a decree, an enactment, that they should accept testimony only from those who they know are trustworthy. All right, so now the question is, who are these by Susan? Okay? There were sectarians. In other words, people who did not follow the rules and the regulations that have been established as the normative Jewish practice. Okay? we actually have three different categories who are mentioned. One of them is not mentioned over here, but we know that usually we speak about, for example, by Susim and Snukim. The by Susim were the followers of somebody by the name of Isis, or they usually spell in English a Greek name, Boethius or something like that. And the Tzedukim are the people who we call Sadducees. In other words, the followers of Tzedok, a high priest who became the leader of their group. Okay? They held different interpretations of the Torah. They were not exactly identical, but both the Bisusim and Tzedukim, for example, were alike in one respect. And that is in establishing what is the date of Shavuos. What is the date of Shavuos? Okay. What's the problem? What is the date of Shavuos? We know that we count what? We count 50 days. Yes, Hashem, when we finish our shir tonight, we'll count Sfira, right? You count 50 days, B'mocharas HaShabbos. It's written specifically in the Torah, from the morrow of the Sabbath. So naturally, the question is, what is the meaning of Shabbos in that context? So how do we interpret it? We say that Shabbos means the first day of Pesach. So in other words, beginning with when the first day of Pesach ends, the following day, this is when we start into count, right? And it's our practice to this very day. The second night of Pesach, we already begin counting. Okay? Incidentally, of course, by us, it's the second day Yom Tov. In Eretz Yisrael, it's already Chol HaMoed that night, okay? It's quite an experience. It's a cultural shock for a person who observes 2 days Yom Tov to see what happens on the second day Yom Tov, when for them it's Chol HaMoed, and the buses are running, cabs are running, and so on and so forth. And of course, we poor people, we had to observe a second day Yom Tov. I was fortunate that I was able to find one minion in the entire neighborhood where they had a special minion for people who observe second day Yom Tov. Okay, at any rate, the wording of the Torah says on the morrow of the Sabbath, right? The Tzedukim and the Bisusim, they held that literally it means that Shavuos must always fall on what day of the week? Always Saturday night and Sunday. Why? Because they interpreted the word Shabbos not the way we did. They interpreted Shabbos mean Taka Shabbos, the seventh day of the week. We interpret Shabbos as referring to Yom Tov. Because, for example, in connection with Yom Kippur, what do they say? They call it Shabbat Shabboson, right? So, therefore, a Yom Tov, you know, one of the major festivals, is also it's the Shabbos Ladisha. Okay. So, that was one of the points of difference. Now, because they had this point of difference, therefore the Bisusim made Tzoras, because they wanted to make sure that what would happen, that the date of Shavuos would fall Taka on Sunday, right? And therefore they tried to influence the decision of the Beis Din in Yerushalayim that they should either add a day or subtract a day or something like that, so that the calendar would agree with their point of view. Now, that being the case, they made Tzoras. And when they made Tzoras, then in that particular case, then the sages said, we cannot trust the testimony, because as we'll see in a few moments in Gemara, the Bisusim are not above spreading, you know, sending false witnesses in order to influence the decision of the Beis Din. As far as the Tzedukim were concerned, they had a different shita. The Tzedukim said that we only observe those things which are written in the Torah, and we will not observe anything else. In other words, we reject what we call the oral law. Okay. The third group that we had in those days, of course, the Kusim. Who were the Kusim? Not be left the Gemara in Kedushin yet, you know, that they were the descendants of the Samaritans who had been imported from the far stretches of the Assyrian Empire by the Assyrians when they conquered northern Israel. And they mixed with the local population, but their practices were not 100% pure Yiddishkeit. They had other pagan practices as well. That's what the Gemara said, if you remember, in Kedushin we had. Okay. So, here they don't mention the kusam, but they will later on too. All right, so this is what the Mishnah reads. Now, the Gemara immediately has a question. It says, "My acher." What do you mean by acher? In other words, the word another in the Mishnah that we just finished. Chad, does it mean that one person, that was it? You have the next page? Because I gave two pages, right? Yeah. The Chad bim Haman, and can one witness be trusted? Right? Because after all, what did the Torah say? The Torah says you have to have two witnesses. So how can you trust one witness, right? The Hot Tanya, didn't we learn in the Baraisa, which says, Maaseh shebo hu v'yedo v'imo, a man came together with his witnesses with him, lo ho'id olov, so that they should testify concerning him that he was, a trustworthy witness, right? So again, here it would seem to be what? That we're talking about an individual witness. So I'm a Rav Papa. So Rav Papa says, no, not so. He says, my acher. What do we mean by acher, another? He says, zug acher. That means another group of witnesses. Zug means a couple, a pair, right? In other words, he says we have to have another pair of witnesses in order to come and to testify. Okay. Hochi nami, so likewise, Mistabra, it makes sense, the Eloi Tema Hochi, that if you don't say, as we interpret it this way, Imeinu Makir Nosei, my Osei, when the Mishnah says that they do not recognize him, what do we mean by him? Eloima Osei, if we say him individually, Chad V'Chadmi Mehemon, right? How can you say chad? We mean only that one individual, the chad bin Haman. Again, getting back, can one witness be considered trustworthy? Mishpat kesivbay. In reference to the proclamation of Rosh Chodesh, this goes back to a famous pasuk that we have in Tehillim. We say it as a part of our Thursday morning psalm, if you remember. We say tiku b'chodesh shofar, right? Blow the new moon on the new moon, the shofar. On the festival which we observe, meaning of course Rosh Hashanah, when the moon is covered, because that's the only festival wherein you don't see the new moon, right? Ki chok liYisrael hu, because this is a statute unto Israel. Mishpat Elohei Yaakov, this is like a judgment, right, of the God of Jacob, the God of the Jewish people. So the word Mishpat, right, is written in reference to this, right? Mishpat Sibay. And what do we know? We know that normally in any Mishpat, right, in any case coming before the court, how many witnesses do we have to have? We have to have two at least, right? So that therefore this is what they're saying, okay? Mishpat Sibay. Elamai Oso. So what do we mean then by Oso? The main Makirin Oso, they don't know him. It says Oso Hazug. It means that group, the two witnesses. In other words, if they don't know the two witnesses, that they are trustworthy. So Ochinami. So that's the case. By Achir, what do you mean by another one? So it's a Zugacher. Okay? It means one other pair. Alright, I'm going to stop at this point and we'll start next week, Amirta Hashem, with carrying out this question again, whether one witness can actually ever also be considered trustworthy or not. Okay, tonight is the 17th, I believe, of the month of May in the year 2000, and we are continuing right now in Rosh Hashanah, Chaf Beis, Amud Beis, and we continue where we left off previously, the previous week. Just want to call your attention that next week, because of the fact that it's the Israel Bonds dinner, I'll be working over here in the kitchen. So I won't be able to give a shiur, okay? But we'll be 2 weeks from tonight, and yes, Hashem, and continue looking. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now, all right. So now, we have established up to this point the fact that when it comes to giving testimony that they had seen the new moon and that they could bring that testimony to the Beis Din in Yerushalayim, that even though it is written in the singular in the Mishnah over here, right, Eid and Oso and Acher and so on, these are all singular forms of words, but nevertheless we established the principle that what? That witness, that the testimony of a witness is not accepted as a single witness. Instead, it has to be at least two witnesses in order to testify. Of course, last week I mentioned that it's not true in every single case, because there are areas in which one witness is believed. As I pointed out, that for example, if it comes to testifying the fact that they had seen a person had died, man had died, then they want to be able to bring that testimony so that the widow would be able to be, remarry, and she would not be in the guna, you see. So their testimony of one person is accepted. And as we saw, not only a testimony of one man, but the testimony of a woman will be accepted. Testimony even of an eved, so of a slave, would be accepted for that. As long as they saw it, then they could possibly, identify that the person who has died, and you know, and you give a coherent story, then in that case they're willing to accept it. Or as I pointed out, that for example in certain cases like Issa v'Heter, when it comes, for example, let's say a question, a shaila, you know, whether a drop of milk fell into a fleshic pot or something like that, then the testimony of one person is sufficient in order to determine how to judge what the din should be.
I realize my ignorance.
A quarter moon is already beyond the new moon. The new moon is a thin crescent that appears up in the sky.
Okay.
So the quarter moon is already the seventh night of the month normally. Mm-hmm. And as you can see right now, we're progressing towards the 14th or the 15th, because you can see that the moon is getting fuller and fuller.
Right.
When we can see the moon, that is. But,
28 days divided by 4, you got
right.
77 days.
Yeah, approximately.
But now you
right.
The question is the first sliver.
Right, the first sliver. When they had seen that, that's the time that the witnesses would come to the Supreme Court of the Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, and they would report over there that they had seen it. And then, on the basis of their testimony, if it was accepted, then in that particular case they would say that the month is Mekudosh, the month has been sanctified, and now that this is officially Rosh Chodesh. And of course it's important, particularly not just for Rosh Chodesh but Rosh Hashanah, because Rosh Hashanah itself occurs on the first day of the month of Tishrei, so you have to know definitely when exactly is Rosh Hashanah. Alright, so we are now on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We're on the seventh line now of Chaf Beis Omid Beis. You got it? Okay, good. So let's continue over there. Now they're going to question this question whether you need two witnesses. V'chad lo mehemon? And you mean to tell me that one witness would not be considered trustworthy? V'ho Tanya, didn't we learn a story which tells that Maaseh Rabbi Nehorai, it's a story about Rabbi Nehorai, Sheholach Eitzel Ho'ed, he went together with the witness, says the witness, right, the Ho'ed Olav, right, in order to testify concerning him, in other words, to give like a character reference, you know, that this witness was trustworthy, right, and not only that, it was B'Shabbos, it was on the Sabbath. Well, we've already discussed, you know, about the dispensation given to a witness in order to come before the Beis Din Yerushalayim, even though it would be beyond the Tom Shabbos, right? And where was it? It was Be'usha. In other words, where's Rabbi Nehorai? He was in the city of Usha. Usha is a city in the northern Israel, okay, quite a distance from Yerushalayim. So we can see that for him, in order to get to Yerushalayim, was quite a feat. And not only that, but it was also on Shabbos, right? So.
And he desecrated the Shabbos to do this.
No. Well, we said that the dispensation was given that they could walk beyond the Tum Shabbos in order to give testimony that they had seen the new moon, so that the Beis Din would be able to fulfill the mitzvah declaring that the new month had begun. Yes, Dan.
If he's up in the north,
right.
How long would it take to get to New Plymouth?
A long time.
Days.
Yeah.
Sure.
It'll take a long time. Right.
So he's got to figure how many days he passed his thoughts.
Right, right. Okay. But obviously, it was a long journey. And in order to get to Yerushalayim, he and the witness, you know, who he wanted to support, would actually have to walk quite a distance, even on Shabbos, in order to get there. Okay. The other week, I don't know if you were here, when I was talking about the principle of Shavuos, you know, where certain things we prohibit in order to make sure that no greater violation would take place, and that the business of Tchumim is more or less also like a matter of Shavuos. I mean, we don't do it not so much because the Torah prohibits it, because the Torah doesn't specifically mention it, it just says not to go out of your place. But what do we mean, not to leave your place? So, on the basis of the fact that towards the end of Sefer Bamidbar, we speak about the boundaries of the cities given to the Levium, that they have a boundary 2,000 amos, right? So, on that basis, they say, therefore, the Tzachum is 2,000 amos, and not to go beyond that. Unless we make an error beforehand. Then in that case, they give you another stretch. Okay. Right. But here it's a heter. So, at any rate, it would seem then that he is giving support to only one witness, right? It's a character witness for the witness. And we're not saying over here a pair of witnesses. You understand? This is, well, this is the argument right now. So, Amre. And not only that, but when he got to the Beis Din, the people said, Rabbi Nahorai. Ooh, Rabbi Nahorai says, Sador. Okay, he's a real witness, but you know what they say? Sador Achrina Hava Bahadeh. There was another witness in addition to Rabbi Nahorai. So, the Hordele Choshev Leid, so why wasn't mention made of the fact that there was no, that there wasn't another person who went along also to witness? So as it says, Mishum Kavodah Shel Rabbi Nahorai, this is in order to give honor to Rabbi Nahorai. In other words, he's such a great man that they don't want to diminish his kovod by mentioning somebody else who went along. But in reality, there were two.
Rabbi Nahorai there to vouch for the one
to
witness.
To vouch for the one, witness, it would seem, right.
And so the other one who was with him is
also vouching.
That they, because the Sanhedrin would know the
right. Evidence. Correct. But on the basis of this, we would seem to infer that what the one witness should be sufficient when it comes to Eidus HaChodesh, right, to give testimony concerning the new moon. So, Rav Ashi said, Rabbi Nahorai, Sado Achrino Hava. He says, he was like a second witness, or there was another witness, Be'usha, in the city of Usha. He also Rabbi Nahorai. And so, Rabbi Nahorai came, leads to Rufi Bahadeh, in order to join him. So he says, if that's the case, Ma'ilam Imra, what do we mean then when we said just above, Mahu Detema? And what if you would say, in other words, that one witness would be acceptable? That's not what we're saying. We're saying Misfeka says, okay, we have doubts in this matter about the whole deal. What is the doubt that we have in this whole deal over here? We're not denying that normally we have to have two witnesses. We're not denying that. But there's another problem that arises over here, and that is Misfeka. Since we have a question of doubt as to the character of the witness, and we don't know, and he needs character or corroboration, so, then in that particular case, we should not permit the violation of Shabbos. So, Kamash Malon. Therefore, we learn that it's so important for the Beis Din to be able to proclaim the new moon in its proper time that it is permissible to Mechal of Shabbos, even if you're in doubt as to whether your testimony will be needed or not. So this is where we arrive at this particular point.
But Hazel means what?
Hazel means to go.
Just to go.
Right, yeah.
Why was there doubt about the witness? The rabbi,
Rabbi Nahum, right.
They went along, he has such a great reputation, he is vouching for him.
Okay, but again, the question is simply this, whether the violation of the Shabbos was permissible where...
He
wasn't the actual witness, exactly. He was not the witness, he's only a character.
So therefore
he desecrated the Shabbos, but they said, no, in this case it was permitted for the same reason. In other words, in order to proclaim the new moon, you had to have witnesses who had seen, and we had to have character witnesses to corroborate the fact that, the witnesses who appeared before the Beis Din were people whose testimony could be relied upon. Yeah, right.
Well, it's all part of the same matter.
Yeah.
It's all intrinsic. It was all part of the same...
Correct. Right.
It had to be so.
Right. And the fact that they mentioned Rabbi Noah Rai proves the fact that even a person as important as him, nevertheless, of course, it's a question of doubt, yet they permitted, the Chilul Shabbos and the way we explain it, to go beyond the Chilul Shabbos.
The Sanhedrin didn't meet on the Shabbos, did they?
Yeah, that's a good question. Normally they would not meet. No.
So therefore it had to be after Shabbos that he met with them.
Okay, that could be right. But in order to get to Yerushalayim, in order to appear before them, Moitzoy Shabbos, let's say, they still have to travel on Shabbos to get there. Yeah. All right.
Well, after Shabbos, you've got to use the donkey or a horse.
Correct. I don't know about how many horses they had. The donkeys were much more common. It's transportation. Okay. Now, Kiyosa Ula. When Ula came, this always, whenever you have that expression, Kiyosa, so-and-so came, it means that he came to Babylonia after first being in Eretz Yisrael and learning in the academies and yeshivas of Eretz Yisrael. And he brings back a report of what it is that he had learned in Eretz Yisrael so that the scholars of Babylonia in the yeshivas there would know what the ruling, what the discussion is in Eretz Yisrael. So Ula came and Omar, and he told the scholars in Babylonia, Kitshuha Liyacha B'marav, says that they had sanctified the month in the Ma'arava. Ma'arava means literally in the west, which means in Eretz Israel. Okay? The people in Babylonia consider themselves as being in the east, and in Eretz Israel they were in the west. Okay? So Omar Rav Khan has said, in reference to that, he says, Lo Mibaye Ulu Negavar Rabahu, Dimehemon, says, hey, we don't even have to mention the name of Ula, because we know he is a great man, a great scholar, and he certainly is trustworthy. But you know what? He says, Elo afilo inish de almo nami meheman. He says, but even if any Tom, Dick, or Harry had come back from Eretz Yisrael and reported to us that he knows that the Beis Din had sanctified the new month, he can also be believed. So, my Tama, with what reason can anybody be believed in that particular case? So we come to a very interesting klal over here, an interesting rule. It says, "Kol milsa, the avida legluye." It says, if it's any matter which eventually is going to be revealed to be true, in other words, it's going to be right. So in that case, lo mishakri bo inshe. And people are not going to tell lies about it. I mean, everybody can see what a moon looks like. And if they see from the shape of the moon, that obviously new moon had already been officially declared. So, and the report will get back eventually too, because the people to whom it's written. So in that particular case, we can rely upon the fact he's not going to tell a lie. There's no point his telling a lie, because people can see that it would be a lie if so. Okay. Tanya Nami Hochi. Likewise, we learned along the same lines. Bo echad b'sofa olam. If somebody came even from the very ends of the earth, far, far away, obviously is what it means. The Omar, and he said, Kitchu Beis Din Sachoidesh, that the Beis Din has sanctified the new month, and obviously he gave a time, a date, and so on and so forth, let it happen. So now, we believe him, because for the same reason that this kind of a testimony can be very obviously, can be very readily checked, and we know that people, if they know that their testimony is going to be checked immediately, then they're not going to tell a lie about it.
Now, how does this square with the fact that the Sanhedrin sometimes would tweak or twist the timing?
Okay.
See, because if you say that, well, you know that if you're going to, if you say that the new moon has already appeared,
right?
You know, people can will see in a day or two that appear in backwards.
Yeah.
Then the Sanhedrin would try to push it away or push it forward.
Right. Yeah. The answer is that they can only do it if it's a question of one day. Obviously, 2-3 days, it's not going to work. Period. For the same reason that we said it's going to be obvious to all. But if, let's say, it's a situation where the Sanhedrin could convince a witness either that Hitaka had seen the new moon, or that maybe what he had seen was a cloud, a reflection of light, or something or other, and it was not the new moon, and it was important for what purpose, the answer is to make sure, for example, that Yom Tevin should not occur on a day which is no good. As we already discussed the fact that, for example, we don't want Yom Kippur to occur either on a Friday or on a Sunday.
Right.
That's right.
Because it involves too many problems. So, that being the case, you see, then if it's a matter of one day in order to work it out so that the calendar would be good, then that's it. Yeah, the principle is, for example, that Rosh Hashanah cannot occur the first day Adu. What do I mean, Adu? It cannot start on Sunday, it cannot start on Wednesday, and it cannot start on Friday. Okay. So, two of them have to deal with the fact because we want to avoid Yom Kippur occurring, you know, on the wrong day of the week. The other one actually is in reference to Hoshana Rabbah, because so important is the ceremony of marching around the Hakofes and binding the willow shoes in those days. Today we beat them on the ground, if you remember, or wherever you beat them, on the bench and so on, right? But so important is it that we have a Hoshana Rabbah on a weekday, because on Shabbos you can't do it. So therefore, they made arrangements on the calendar that it should occur, you know, that Rosh Hashanah should not occur in such a way that Hoshana Rabbah is going to be on a Shabbos, which we want to avoid by all means. Okay. So, with that in mind, the Beis Din might either use a little persuasion one way or another. But if they didn't have a legitimate reason, then that was not necessary. And sometimes people do make mistakes. I mean, they think that they see something that they don't see. All right. The Mishnah then continues and says, "Boreshoino yimakam b'midas hakodesh b'kol oda." At first, in earlier days, the Beis Din would receive testimony, as they would accept testimony from the fact that, you know, that the new moon had been seen, from any person. Any person, whatever, could come and be a witness before the Beis Din.
Any Jew.
Yeah, obviously, any Jew. Yeah. But afterwards it says, "Bishakilkalu ha'inim," but, you know, when the sectarians, you know, the heretics, they started to make all kinds of tzoras, in order to destroy the validity and power of the Beis Din, in that particular case, then they have to be more circumspect. So this is now what they're going to discuss. Tanu Rabbanan, sages taught us as follows, Ma kilkul kilkulum, Abai says, tell me, what exactly was the nature of the destructive act that the Abai Susim committed? Remember, we heard a few minutes ago what I'd spoken about the Abai Susim, that they were sectarians, not as extreme as, for example, the Tzedukim, but nevertheless, they wanted to make sure that Shavuos would always occur on Sunday. Because they interpreted, you know, the Machras of Shabbos as meaning specifically that. Okay. So, what did they do, what did these Abai Susim do in order to throw off the whole business of the fact that what is the proper day of Rosh Chodesh. So they explained, Habachas, once happened that Bikshu by Susim Lahatis Chachamim, that the by Susim wanted to deceive our sages. Sochru Shnei Bnei Yodom, so they hired two people. Not only that, but Bedalat Meos Zuz, they paid each of them 400 zuz. It's a small fortune, right? And who are these two witnesses? It says Echon Mishalonu. One of them was from Unzra mention. In other words, he is more inclined to sympathetic to the rabbinic point of view, right? The Echon and the other one, Mishalohem, one of the Baisusim. So the two of them came before the best thing, right? Shalohem, hey, they do say viyotza. Now remember, they didn't question the witnesses together. Instead, what would they do? They would question the witnesses separately in order to make sure that the testimony, jived exactly. Okay? So they first called in the one who was, from the Bais Susim. And he gave his testimony, right? And he left the room. Shalonu, when he came to the other person, who was from Unzra mention, as I said, so Amrulai, they said to him, Emor, tell him. Says, Kate Sadraisis Halabona. How did you see the moon? Not how did you see, but it means really, what did the moon look like when you observed it? Okay? What shape, where it was in the sky, and things like that. Because these are questions that they would always ask the witness in order to make sure that the testimony really was valid. Okay? So he came and with a cock and bull story over here, as we'll see right now. No, it doesn't say that. Okay. So Obalahem, so he said to them, you know what? He says, he says, I was climbing up in Malei Adumim. Yeah, that's where my son lived for many years.
Right.
Now that he's living in Beit Shemesh. Okay,
Baruch Hashem. Close enough to Yerushalayim.
Right. Malei Adumim is to the east of Yerushalayim, it's a few miles to the east. Okay. And he says, so I went up, I climbed up in Malei Adumim, which is very high, by the way, because from there you can overlook the whole area. You can take a look and see the Dead Sea down below. You see the Kingdom of Jordan on the other side of the river, the Mount Nebo, where Moshe Rabbeinu passed away, and so on. And in the opposite direction, you can even see as far as Yerushalayim if necessary. There are mountains in there, but still, for example, you could see from where David lived, you could see the buildings of the Hebrew University, on Mount Scope and so on. Naturally, it would have to be a good day. If it was cloudy, you couldn't see it. So, at any rate, I went up to Malei Adumim, or Isiv, and he says, and I saw the moon. Shehu Ravutz ben Shnei Sloim. Says, the moon was crouching between two rocks. The moon.
It's nice, poetic.
Right. Rosho Domela Egel, he says, the head of the moon looked like that of a calf. Okay? Osnov, the ears of the moon, Domin Ligdi, they looked like a goat. Karnov, the horns of the moon, Domos Tzvi, they looked like those of a deer. It was Novo, and his tail, Munachas Lo Ben Yarkisov. His tail was slung between his thighs. Vitzatzti, and I looked at it. Vinirtati, and I got frightened. Vinofalti Lacharai, and I fell backwards. Vyumei Natem Aminim Li, and if you don't believe me, Are Masayim Zuz Sarun Li Bisadini. Here are the two, 400 that they offered to the two witnesses, and it was split 50-50. All right. It says that here are the 200 zuz wrapped in my kerchief, he says. because in those days they didn't have pocketbooks and things like that. So what did they do? They took a sheet or whatever it was, a kerchief, right? And they would put the money in and they would tie it up, make sure it had plenty of knots to it in order that it shouldn't fall out. And it says here, here's the money that they paid me in order to give this testimony. So obviously, when they heard this, they knew that this testimony is not to be relied upon, and therefore they also apostled, you know, they refused to accept the testimony of the other witness, the one, the Baisusin, you know, the one who was doing it. And they realized that the Baisusin were doing, you know, were willing to suborn witnesses in order to scotch the whole business, you know, the authority of the Beis Din to declare the proper proper yibum. So Amar lo, so they said to him, "Mi hizkika cho lechach?" Tell me, who put you up to tell us such a baba maisa? So Amar lehem, so he said unto them, "Shamati," I said, "I heard." He said, "Shebikshu baisusim lahatis hachachomim." I heard that the baisusim were planning to deceive the sages. So Amarti, so for that reason I said, "Eleichani, I'll go and give testimony to Yoti Alahem," right? And I will give testimony to them. Shemo yevo b'nei odom she'inam hugonim. And this is in order to be sure that other people who were not good people, in other words, who were shoyim, somebody who were not proper people, you know, would not, so that they shouldn't be in turn bribed by the paisusim, the yatvus chachomim, and they would deceive the sages. In other words, I did it myself in order to make sure that the sages would not be deceived, and I wanted to make sure that other witnesses wouldn't come who would be suborned and give false testimony. Omulo, so they said to him, "Mosaim zuz tzinim loch, you can keep these 200 b'matona, we give them to you as a gift," right? The asochrech, and the person who hired you to give this testimony, yimosach al ha'amud, he should be stretched out over a column. Now, what is this stretched out over a column? We learned in the Gemara, Malkus, towards the end, that how did they actually administer Malkus? How did they do it? So, what they did is that they would take the guy, bend him over a stand, an omer, right? And they would tie his hands over there, and that way his back was exposed. And, you know, they could give him, if you remember, 13 klap from the back, 13 from the front, and then finally another 13 from the back, because it was a total of 39, assuming that, you know, he was able to do it. But we also learned that if he couldn't do it, then they would stop. Or if a doctor said his band is in no physical condition to be able to do it. So in that particular case, you know, they would cut down the number and so on in the courts. Okay, but this is what they're saying. The person who hired you, he should receive Malkus. Okay? B'yosha Shah, so at that moment, Iskinu, they made a decree, "Shelo yuhu mekablin ela menach makirin." From this point on, we're not going to accept the testimony of anybody unless we know exactly who they are. Okay. Right.
It again says a loyal Jew. It implies that the fellow was not a Jew. In other words, they were by Susan were...
They were Jews, but not very good ones.
Not considered loyal Jews.
Right, yeah. Okay. And that they wanted to have character witnesses for whoever came in order to give the Eidus
HaKodesh.
New Mishnah.
This is Elamin
HaMakirin. Elamin HaMakirin, except for those people who we know personally, that you know, that they're trustworthy, or that we have other witnesses who come in order to testify to the trustworthiness of...
Because I don't know what it says to you in this story, but it sounds to me as if the by Sosin hired two Jews. They didn't use people out there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course they hired two Jews.
All right, so, okay, so...
But one of them was secretly sympathetic to Jewish tradition.
Right.
And the other one was one of their own.
Right.
Obviously, they didn't know that the one whom they had hired, the one who was sympathetic to you know, the Chachomim, that he was sympathetic to the Chachomim. It so happened that the guy, he explains, he volunteered his service in order to make sure that somebody else who was not so ethical and, or who did not believe, you know, in the doctrines of the Purushim, the doctrines of the Chachomim, you know, should give false testimony instead. Okay? So this is what it is. All right. Now, the first part is not hard, but after that, we'll see in a moment that in the next page they go into all kinds of trees, and I have to confess in all ignorance that I'm not a tree expert. And Rashi tried to explain what are these various trees, but if he tries to explain it in old French, it's not very helpful either to us. Okay, but I know that the Nod Scroll, the translator, did try to give some sort of translation. So, we'll see. Right. Prior to that, I must say that the business of the trees is based upon a quotation that we find in Yeshayahu, Prophet Isaiah. And obviously, Yeshayahu knew his trees very well. So, I wish I had Yeshayahu's knowledge. I have to confess I don't. All right. The Mishnah starts by saying, Barishayna, in early days, Hoyamasin Masuas, they would light like bonfires, okay? So that was the way that they signaled, you know, that the new moon had been officially declared, right? Then, Mishakilkalu HaKusim. Now it says, when the Kusim, when the Samaritans came and they tried to, you know, to make all kinds of problems, right? They destroyed the Kilkul, you know, so something goes wrong, right? When they did that, so Ishinu, then the sages made a takona, they made a decree, Sheyuhush Luchin Yotzin, that instead of lighting bonfires, that they would send out messengers in order to inform the communities when Rosh Chodesh is. Okay? So, now we go back. Since we said in the early days is what they used to do. Remember, in the previous Mishnahs, we spoke about the fact that shluchim, you know, that emissaries go out for the best in order to spread the news. This is what we have at the end of the first chapter, okay? But now they go back to what was the earlier system. The earlier system was lighting fires in order to... But because the fact that the Samaritans created chaos with the lighting of the fire, so that's when our sages decided from that point on they're going to send emissaries instead. So now the Mishnah goes back and it wants to know, well, what is the nature of the bonfires? How did it work?
Yep. They're sending messengers after they identified the new one, right?
Yes, correct.
Right.
Don't confuse Adam and Shluchim.
I understand.
Because if you remember, we learned Adam, the witnesses, they were allowed to violate the law of Tchum Shabbos,
yeah,
in order to come and to give their testimony to the Beis Din,
right,
so that the Beis Din would be able to declare that it was Rosh Chodesh. Then they sent emissaries, but the emissaries were not allowed to violate Shabbos Hayom.
Yeah.
Okay? Because people would see the moon and so, you know, they could sort of begin to guess as to when it would be, even if they hadn't heard an official word. Okay? But of course, on that basis too, we see why it was important, you know, for people to begin to observe 2 days of Yom Kippur, because they didn't know for certain whether it was this day or whether it was Palm. Was it on the 30th day, or was it on the 31st day?
No.
Yeah.
Here where Yossi is, I remember years and years ago, driving there and beyond, when you could go a little bit to the West Bank. I remember someone pointing out to me a hill, said this is one of the hills where they had the Madura. They would have like the fire to use signal fires.
Yeah, that could very well be, right? Because obviously it had to be from a place where it could be seen. Okay.
Right.
And we'll see that
place. Yeah.
Right. Okay. But so we're going to have names of places, but we don't always know.
They only send out the shluchim that would be reliable?
Yeah, the shluchim, the best, them were reliable people, of course. Obviously, they carried credentials. They didn't send any Tom, Dick, or Harry. They carried, you know, they sent out people who had the proper credentials.
Yeah.
Okay, so Now, as I say, the Mishnah now wants to know Ketzad. In what way, Hoyamasi and Masus, did they make these fires? It says, Medin Klunso Eshel Eres. First of all, they would take poles of cedar wood, Arukin, which were long. Obviously, if you had a long pole, it could be seen at a distance when they lit it, right? The Konim, and also reeds, the Atze Shemin, and also wood, which produces oil, and it's something, I suppose, like a resinous wood, right? Una Oreshel Pishnon, and also the chaff of flax, in other words, things that could be easily ignited, right? The Korech, and he would tie around these things, Bimshicha, with a cord. The oil of the Rosh HaHor, and then he would go up to the top of the hill, or mountain, whatever you want to call it, the Matzis Behenes HaHor. And he would light with these things the fire. He would light it, okay? Umoylech Umevi. And he would make the following signal. First, Molech means that he would put it out. Maybe he brings it back. Umala, then he raises it. Umorin, and then he lowers it. And obviously, he would do this not once, but he would do it more than once, because it says, Ad shehu roes chadero, to the point where he can see that the next person over there, who's on, you know, on another mountain, that he's doing likewise at the top of the next hill, or on the other hill. Alright, likewise in the third hill or mountain. So this is the way it went, and of course it went until the point, you know, that actually it reached the community in Babylonia. And from where did they start with the first bonfire? The answer is Mehar HaMishcha. They would start from the Mount of Mishcha, means literally olive oil. In other words, what we call the Har HaZesim, okay? The Mount of Olives, which is just to the east of the Temple Mount. Obviously, they got the word from the Sanhedrin, right? And immediately the Sanhedrin would send somebody over to tell them it's Rosh Chodesh, and so that's what they would make the first bonfire, okay? Either it's a bonfire or a high torch or something, you know, whatever they use in order to signal. The reason why I say bonfire is because the Hebrew word that Rashi uses is Medura. And we'll see it at the end of this Mishnah again. And Medura means a bonfire. You know, like Gomer is coming. And if you notice as well, any time, beginning with Pesach, you'll know that the kids are busy gathering every scrap of wood that they can find in order to make a tremendous bonfire on Lag BaOmer. And of course, the biggest ceremony of the lighting of the bonfire is in the town of Meron, where they have the tomb of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai.
Oh, yeah, Festival of Meron.
Festival
sure.
of Meron, of course. Yeah. The thousands upon thousands of people come and gather over there at the Kever Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai in order to celebrate Lag BaOmer. And this is the time when they have the Upsheren.
Yeah,
the Chassidim, right? They have the upshare, and then they take the hair and they throw it into the fire.
So you burn it.
Yeah. And so it's in memory of that that the rabbi has been waiting until Lag BaOmer to cut his son Yoni's hair.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, so they started, the first fire was on Mount of Olives, Har HaMishcha. And the next one would be Sartaba, wherever that is. When it's Sartaba, then the lights, you know, would be seen in Grofina, the Grofina. Me Grofina, the Chavron. It goes to Chavron. Chavron may something have to do with the Golan Heights, possibly, I don't know. And anyway, and from there, the base built it. The base built in, now this was the last stop, base built in, because from there they didn't go any further, but they would do the signaling, you know, of forward and backward and up and down and so on, until he could see that the entire Gola, by this they mean all Babylonia, looked like one great big bonfire. In other words, everybody got into the act and lit the lights and so on, so it looked like one great big bonfire. Yeah. So the Gemara says, "My mashma," and how do we know? The Masiyin Lishna the Yikud, who? How do we know that the word Masiyin means lighting a fire? Because normally they don't use the word in this particular sense. Normally they don't. Normally the word Lahasi means, for example, to marry off somebody. Lahasi et Drito, for example, a person, you know, marries off his daughter or something like that. But how do we know that here, in this context, this is exactly what it means? By the way, I spent a very delightful week years and years ago in a place called Matsuot Yitzchak, which was the name of one of the original Moshavim, religious one, in the area, you know, around between Hebron and Yerushalayim, and then of course the Arabs overran it.
Gush
Etzion, exactly. Yeah, and so afterwards, after you know, the year 48, when the Arabs murdered the Jews at the Gush Etzion, so they reestablished. It's actually not too far from Ashkelon. They established so Masuot Yitzchak. To this day, that's all existence. So, and it was named literally, you know, the bonfires of Yitzhak, based upon this over here. All right, so how do we know that the word Masiyin over here, in this particular case, refers to making a fire? So it says this, if we have a pasuk. Pasuk says, Vayisoeim David van Hoshon. Okay. This is a reference to a story that we find about King David, that he conquered a place, and it was full of idols. So what happened? So his men, David and his men, they yisoeim, okay? And what is umetargeminen? What is the taich that we find, the Aramaic taich? So the answer is, they translate it as the ugdina David, right? That David and the others, they set it on fire, okay? So now we know that in this particular case, this is what it means in that particular context, namely that what did David and his men do after they conquered? The answer is they burnt the idols. Okay. All right, so now we've established the fact that Masiyin over here means making a fire. Tanu Rabban, our sages taught the following. It says, Ein Masiyin Masuos, El Alam.